Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Kristen from Williamsburg, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
As the 80s became the 90s, a new sound out of the UK began to rumble across the Atlantic, built around heavily distorted guitars that masked often surprisingly melodic vocals. Anyone who cared to trace the sound back to its source would soon discover a Scottish band known as the Jesus and Mary Chain. Their groundbreaking album Psycho Candy is considered by many to be the first and finest in the so-called shoegaze genre, and it's about to turn 30 years old. And we are joined today by Zoe Howe, author of the biography Barbed Wire Kisses, The Jesus and Mary Chain Story. Zoe, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So your book is out at around the same time that Psycho Candy turns 30. Is that a reflection of the album's significance at the time?
Well, to be honest, it's kind of it's very happy coincidence, I would say, because when I was working on the book, I mean, when you sort of come up with a concept for a book, you never really know exactly when it's going to come out. So it's a happy accident. I mean, Psycho Candy actually came out in 85, but it's very much kind of anniversary time for the Mary Chain, because 84 was a big year for them. So yeah, I mean, it's a sort of like, you know, really nice timing that it's all kind of come together. You couldn't have planned it better. Sometimes when you try and plan these things, they don't work out. So.
Well, now here in the States, you know, the Jesus and Mary Chain are known for a couple of singles, neither of which were particularly distorted sounding. What was their place in the UK scene in the middle of the 1980s?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, because I think the way that the Mary Chain have been seen for a long time has differed greatly in the UK and in the States. I think they're seen in a very different way in the States. And I think for a long time they were actually respected more in America than they were here, because I think when the Mary Chain were really sort of finding their feet and doing sort of gigs in London and sort of regional gigs, and, you know, they were very much associated with absolute white noise, you know, lots of distortion, quite a lot of onstage violence and a lot of violence in the crowd. There would be riots, and there was a lot of kind of you know, stirring up of, you know, the kind of the hype of what would happen at a Mary Chain gig. Mm. And it was always very unpredictable, and there was, you know, always, quite, you know, trouble. And I think, you know, by the time, I think they grew out of that very quickly. And I think they soon sort of started to see if we want to be taken seriously for our music, because they really did, you know, believe in their music. It always came first. This needs to stop, because we're attracting the wrong people here. But I think by the time they started doing shows in America, the American audiences didn't really have that reference point. They just kind of took them for who they were. And I think that must have been a great relief to them. So they're sort of seen in quite a different way, I think.
Yeah, that seems like it is, in fact, the case. Now, we're talking about not just a band, but two brothers, William and Jim Reed, growing up bored out of their minds in East Kilbride, Scotland, which is near Glasgow, which even then had kind of, I mean, maybe not to the extent now, but even then had a kind of a music scene going on. And it seems like the band, the drinking, and the fighting, the bickering between the two, that all of these things sort of grew up together.
Yes, indeed, they did. And I think, you know, sometimes sort of growing up in definitely what they felt was, it was quite a cultural void, actually did them a favour in a way, because it forced them into going, right, we've got to do something, you know, something creative, something that we can, you know, a way of expressing ourselves, otherwise we'll go mad.
Well, now, you write something interesting early in the book about the two brothers. You know, they're both music obsessives. They're listening to the Velvet Underground. They're listening to the German industrial band Einstürzende Neubauten. And they want to kind of combine that heavy industrial sound with the kind of melodic pop sensibility of the Shangri-Las. I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing you write about early in the book, is the Shangri-Las on top of Neubauten.
Yes, that's absolutely, you know, that's psycho candy, you know, as Jim put it, you know, that basically is psycho and candy put together. That's the equation, the magical Mary Chain equation. And I think it's interesting because obviously, you know, the noise, the sheer noise that a lot of us associate with the Mary Chain, as you say, in later years, they became a little bit more melodic and I think maybe more confident in their voices. And that's why maybe the feedback started to recede. Because you know, at first they were always very, very shy.
So going back to Psycho Candy, which came out in 85, a song like Inside Me, this would be a pretty good example of what you're talking about, right? The sort of the hidden melody under the noise.
Yeah, and I totally. I mean, this one I just love. This encapsulates that whole thing for me. But it's quite mean. This one, it's not so much a sugar pop melody wrapped up in sort of swathes of feedback. This is quite a mean one. But yeah, Inside Me, it's got a sort of nastiness to it. It's like a kind of virus inside you, kind of, you know, whirling around. So yeah, Inside Me, very Mary Chain.
This is from the album Psycho Candy by the Scottish band The Jesus and Mary Chain. Inside Me is the name of that song from the Jesus and Mary Chain, Scottish band from the 1985 album Psycho Candy, their first full-length release. Zoe Howe is with us on Soundcheck. She's the author of the book Barbed Wire Kisses, the Jesus and Mary Chain story. You do talk, Zoe, about how the odd name of the band came about. They were originally the Daisy Chain, right?
Yes, they had a few, you know, they went like all young bands, you know, it takes a while to kind of find the name that you're really happy with. And they had a few, they had like the Poppy Seed, you know, they had all sorts of kind of funny names. And some of them were sort of, you know, they'd have a kind of slightly psychedelic slant. And they loved psychedelia, they, you know, not just the music, but the the substances.
Yes.
There's a lot of inspiration there. But yeah, the Jesus and Mary Chain kind of chimes with Williams, in particular, his sort of preoccupation with subversion of religious themes, I would say. It's got quite a dark feeling about it, the Jesus and Mary Chain. It's nobody really knows what it means. It's so, and he was very into, you know, his lyrics were very surreal. His lyrics were quite, you know, elliptical. So yeah, a very William title.
William, of course, being William Reed, he and Jim Reed, his brother, the two kind of central players in the Jesus and Mary Chain, and around them is this kind of rotating cast of characters who come and go. But the idea that they were famous, I mean, you write that by 1985, the Jesus and Mary Chain were now famous. Who were they famous? Who was their audience?
Well, obviously it started, you know, what really started for them when they moved down to, you know, started doing gigs in London, and they'd eventually moved down to London quite soon when it became clear that things were really starting to happen and people were becoming really excited by them, key people in the music press. And a lot of, well, all of this was really down to Alan McGee taking them on.
Their first manager.
Their first manager and the boss of Creation Records. And he obviously is a great kind of enthusiast for the things that he believes in. And once he gets his teeth into a project or a band or, you know, just anything that he has a passion for, he will, you know, knock on every door that needs to be knocked on and get the right people there. And that's what he did. And so it really started in London. It was quite an, I suppose it was quite a niche audience at first, but it just would grow and grow. So yeah, that's kind of how it started really. But they were very divisive. They remained divisive. They polarized audiences. They weren't sort of roundly loved by any sort of stretch of the imagination. For every few people who were absolutely taken with their sound, there'd be, you know, 20 more at that gig who would be disgusted, or they'd walk out, or they just wouldn't understand what they were seeing, or why these people were just getting away with sort of making this incredible noise.
And very often a racket as well, you know, destroying gear and things like that was certainly, I mean, they seem to have done more gigs drunk than sober. But there is one moment in the book where I think it's Jim says something about how there were all these young, like, teenage girls in the crowd. So these two shy brothers sort of became sex symbols in a way.
They did, and I think they, you know, certainly at first they were quite bemused by that. I don't think they saw themselves as that. But on the other hand, you know, they say that, you know, they're very modest as well. But, you know, you got sort of good-looking guys there. The whole band were, you know, a good-looking bunch of young guys, you know, strutting about in leather trousers and shades. And, you know, kind of playing at being pop stars, really. They grew up with Top of the Pops. They wanted to be Mark Bolan, you know, so there's this strange combination of being very shy and introverted, but also being in love with pop and wanting to be stars. So, you know, in a way, it's not surprising that they attracted, you know, quite a bit of female attention, and that sexiness in pop and rock and roll is absolutely vital, you know, right. You know, otherwise it's not rock and roll.
Now, you talk about how underneath the initial kind of symphony of fuzz and distortion that they would layer in the studio and in their gigs, there was this, you know, the appeal of pop music. Here in the States, the song Sometimes Always became, you know, really their best-known song off the 1994 record Stoned and Dethroned, and it was done with Hope Sandoval from Mazzy Star. So you had this boy-girl, you know, kind of back-and-forth thing. This is very much a pop song, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And in fact, I think that whole album is very melodic, very beautiful. There's a lot of beauty on Stoned and Dethroned. And I think the clue is, you know, in the mood, is in the title, of course. You know, at this point, they were kind of, you know, they were pretty stoned when they were making it, but they also sort of felt dethroned by Britpop, because Britpop had come along absolutely swaggering in, kind of stolen their crown, really, in a way, in the UK. And it was a sort of time of reflection. And the songs, you know, as I say, this album is really quite different in mood.
Let's hear a little bit of Sometimes Always. Once again, speaking with Zoe Howe, author of the new book Barbed Wire Kisses, about this band, the Jesus and Mary Chain. Always from the Jesus and Mary Chain and their 1994 album Stoned and Dethroned, featuring vocals by Hope Sandoval. Zoe Howe, author of the book Barbed Wire Kisses, the Jesus and Mary Chain story, with me on Soundcheck. And Hope Sandoval, I mean, this is, as we were talking about a moment ago, it's a very pop song, it's fun to listen to, but there's a dark vibe in the band when Hope appears on the scene, because she's going out with William and Jim is seeing Yoko breaking up the band, right?
I think there's definitely a sense of that. I mean, Jim is very, you know, when I spoke to him about this, he was quite kind of contrite. He just said, you know, I think I was a bit hard on Hope. And he sort of, you know, it was kind of interesting talking to him and all of them at this time in their life, because, you know, there's a lot of kind of looking back with a certain amount of perspective, and, you know, things have mellowed. And I think he does feel it was a little bit hard on Hope, but it didn't help the band dynamic. I think things were already very strained, you know, as you mentioned before, the relationship between the two brothers as they are often with brothers, pretty tense to say the least, and
Well,
trying to
you
solve
mentioned Britpop, and of course the Gallagher brothers, Oasis, that kind of push-pull
it.
between the two Gallagher brothers has always been a big part of their story. But, it wasn't just Britpop. I mean, we had bands like My Bloody Valentine and the whole so-called shoegaze movement, so-called because the players would be like gazing down at their foot pedals, creating their distortion and stuff. Did the guys in the Jesus and Mary Chain, did William and Jim kind of feel like something, a wave they had started, had now crested and maybe gone over them and gotten away from them?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fair to say that. I mean, one of the interesting things that happened is that Jim's then partner would then start to work with Alan McGee, and Alan would be signing up other shoegaze bands and, the new wave that were very much inspired by the Mary Chain. And, Jim and William would be watching these people get sort of front covers of the Enemy, and they think, hang on, we're being taken over here. And it's kind of part of the natural order of things, I suppose. But I think it was tough. It was definitely tough, especially to see kind of, the people they were close to sort of basically helping these other bands along.
Yeah. So by the time we get to the late 90s and an album like Monkey, where are the Jesus and Mary Chain?
Well, as you say, it's very much Jim and William at the core. It's with other musicians sort of coming and going. And they've now got their own studio, the drugstore in South London, which is where they also made Stone and Dethroned, and they sort of they make Monkey there as well. And Monkey is a really strong album, but it's very much divided in style. That you've got the Jim songs and the William songs. You can really hear the division here, and part of it is probably down to the fact that it got to the stage where they would not be in the studio together at
mm-hmm.
all. So William would come in at night, record his songs, and Jim would come in the day with Ben Lurie and record his songs. So you've got this. It's really, really polarized now. So and very, very sad, but it's incredible, really, how they managed to sort of keep it together as long as they did, considering the mood and, the kind of people they were.
Well, it almost sounds like you're describing the Beatles' White Album. whose song is Man on the Moon, and how do you tell which is a William and which is a Jim song?
Oh, wow. It's a Jim song. Man on the Moon is a Jim song. You hear a lot more sort of William vocals on Monkey. I mean, obviously he is, his voice pops up through the years, but William does sing quite a few songs on Monkey, and his voice is quite distinct. But also the mood of the songs that William writes is a little bit darker, a little bit heavier, often quite, again, sort of very surreal lyrics, sometimes quite obscene lyrics. those are the sort of hallmarks of a William song, I would say, whereas Jim's, there's still a real darkness there and a sharpness there, but sort of more waspish quality, but also a lot of sensitivity. So, those are just a few things that spring to mind, I would say, for differentiating. But Man on the Moon is a sort of, it's sharp, but it's also quite sad. It's quite lonesome. And I think maybe it kind of describes how he was feeling at the time.
All right, let's hear the song Man on the Moon from the Jesus and Mary Chain. Bit of Man on the Moon from the album Monkey, 1998 record by the Jesus and Mary Chain, the Scottish-born band. whose first album, Psycho Candy, came out in 1985. And their blend of distortion and melody would prove to be hugely influential, as Zoe Howe relates in her book, Barbed Wire Kisses, the Jesus and Mary Chain story. Zoe, which were you more surprised at? That William wouldn't talk to you for this book, or that Jim did?
I mean, these are
two guys who were notoriously interview averse.
Both quite surprising in their own way. It was quite interesting because recently, I got the impression that William didn't decline because he was against the idea. I was given the impression it was more that he just couldn't really be bothered to kind of get stuck in, you know, and all the rest of it. Whereas, you know, Jim was sort of, he did say, no, I'm happy to cooperate with this, which was, as you said, was sort of surprising in itself, which and wonderful. I was absolutely thrilled. Although recently someone kind of intimated that a sort of message wasn't quite passed along the chain to William. And I was like, oh no, don't tell me that. Mm. So, I don't know whether maybe if there's an opportunity for a reprint down the line where maybe we will have William in the fold. I really hope so.
So what is their relationship now, the two brothers?
Well, you know, I get the impression it sort of changes all the time, but obviously they're rehearsing for their Psycho Candy shows right now in the UK, so they still play together, they still work together. And I think, you know, when you get to a certain age, you know, you sort of maybe develop a certain understanding of how, you know, how to make the whole operation work, I suppose. But and of course Alan McGee is back in the fold as well. He's taken on their management again, and he, you know, he knows how to deal with them and work with them, and he's just great. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this works out.
Well, the brothers, as the Jesus and Mary Chain, will be doing Psycho Candy, that first record, front to back. You know, this is the thing nowadays. You celebrate an album's release by playing it live in concert, the whole thing, and Jesus and Mary Chain will be doing that. Well, the book is called Barbed Wire Kisses, the Jesus and Mary Chain story. It's by Zoe Howe, who's been with us here on Soundcheck today. And Zoe, it's a great story. Thanks for telling it to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That does it for this podcast, but make sure to check out our archives of live performances, in-studio videos, exclusive music previews, and much more at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time.